This is the Utah Politics Podcast for September 17th, 2021. I'm Brian Schott, political correspondent for the Salt Lake Tribune. I have a pair of conversations on tap for you this week. First, I sit down with Grant Birmingham. He's the new State Watch editor for the Salt Lake Tribune. Basically, he's my new boss. He takes the reins of the political and government reporting team on Monday. We're going to let you get to know him a bit as he talks about his career that took him from paperboy for the Tribune to the New York Times and back to Salt Lake City. We'll also talk a bit about why he thinks it's important for the Tribune to focus on reporting on accountability for our elected officials. After that, I speak with author Ben Mezrich. His book, The Accidental Billionaires, which was about the founding of Facebook, was the basis for the Academy Award-winning movie, The Social Network. He's got a brand new book out. It's called The Anti-Social Network. It looks at the crazy GameStop stock story from earlier this year. Basically, how a group of users on Reddit were able to game the system on Wall Street and throw the financial system into chaos. It's a wild story and a great conversation. I think you'll enjoy it. Before we get to those, though, I would like to ask you to leave a rating and review for this podcast if you have a chance. Just go to Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Podchaser. Leave that review. A five-star review really helps. What that does is it helps new people find the show. You could leave a few kind words about the podcast if you feel like it. I would sure appreciate it. On the podcast today, I'm joined by Grant Birmingham. He is an editor here at the Salt Lake Tribune, and he is moving over on Monday. We are recording this on Thursday. We're moving over on Monday, where he'll be taking over the government and politics team. So we're going to talk a little bit about that, who he is, what he hopes to accomplish as the head of that team. I do have to admit that we recorded this one other time and I screwed up. Something was wrong with recording, so you'll never get to hear it. And it was, frankly, probably one of the greatest interviews ever conducted in the history of mankind. So you'll never hear it, but I know it kind of exists, but it's gone forever. So with that being said, Grant, it's great to have you on again for the first time.
Thanks for having me on, Brian. It's sad that we lost all that into the ether.
But yeah, it was actually a really good conversation. I'm not sure what happened, but let's try to recreate it. But as you know, it'll just be a faint echo of what we were able to accomplish the first time. Okay, so you have you came to the Tribune earlier this year as a breaking news editor. You came here from California, I'm assuming.
Correct.
That's right. Okay. Yep. And before that, you went to the University of Utah, got a job at KUER, the public radio station. I worked up there as well. And then from there, you moved on to New York Times and Yahoo News. So talk a little bit about your career path, even though I just laid the whole thing out for you.
Yeah. So KUER was my big break. I think we might have overlapped for a week or two. I'm trying to.
I don't think so. I left in 2002, I believe. So
okay, that's right when I started.
Oh, so you maybe came in after me, just a little bit after.
Okay.
Me, so.
And that was my big break. And then from there, I got a job at the New York Times, working all over the place, at the website. I ended up running the homepage for a while, and it was kind of a time when the New York Times didn't know how valuable their homepage was, which is a crazy thought since this was 2004. But as a result of that, young person in journalism, I got to attend the A1 meetings at the New York Times every day. I got to decide what headlines were going to be on the website and move things around. And, you know, it was a big job for me at 27, 20, 28. And I look back at that as like when I really cut my teeth and learned what makes a story. I jumped from there to Yahoo News, which was a lot of people were kind of scratching their heads. My friends were scratching their heads at the New York Times. But to me, Yahoo at the time was, you know, this giant platform of news that reached the majority of America. And I used that experience to kind of learn about audience and really learn what connects with people and how I could take big stories and make them approachable and digestible for people. And from there, I had the opportunity to go to Newsweek when they were relaunching. Newsweek ended up moving me out to the West Coast to do tech coverage, which I did for a while. Kind of bounced around in California and then moved out here. And this is sort of my dream job. Delivered papers for the Tribune, actually. So I'm returning as an employee to the Tribune.
Well, that's extremely interesting because I'm curious about your thoughts about how this whole thing worked. When you took over the homepage for the New York Times and then you jumped into a purely digital operation, it's two completely different approaches to the way that you report news, the way that you present the stories. The New York Times, I don't think that you can get a better reputation for a news outlet there. But then when you think about places like Yahoo and the ancillary BuzzFeed and places like that, they were very much in the early days, move fast, break stuff, you know, just try stuff and see what works, throw a lot of stuff in the wall. So how was it being able to operate in those two worlds? And what did you come away from that with?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. The New York Times was very much a place when I was there that was like, this is something important. The editors, who are obviously really smart people, think that this topic should be read. And then Yahoo News was almost the exact opposite. It was like, what does the audience want us to give them today? And it was kind of our job to figure out how you could give that to the audience without just, you know, shoveling them celebrities. And so I worked in hard news at Yahoo, and every day my challenge was like, okay, I'm up against the Kardashians. How do I make this story on Syria click? And, you know, it was fun because I could kind of see the numbers every day. Like, this is how this does. If I frame this slightly differently, if I use a story which connects more with people, then I can get this important topic on the front page.
And now that's become a science these days. I mean, there are literally services out there that big news organizations subscribe to that will tell you what is trending, what is starting to trend, so you can get in on it and start grabbing some of that traffic, because eyeballs, you know, that's the whole currency here these days. I understand that, you know, we're looking for paid subscribers, and that's our bread and butter, but also you got to get people to read your stuff. So it's interesting to look at how that's evolved, and I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that from your perspective, because I look at some of these groups and they charge a lot of money, and I'm like, ooh, I would really like to have that app, but can't afford it. So,
yeah, I mean, so when I was at Yahoo News, which would have been 2010 to 2015, the argument I was constantly making was, if you turn this over to machines, if you just go by clicks, you're going to end up with a product that people won't like. Even though that serves you in the short term, you're ultimately going to end up with something that's really frivolous and not something which people go to every day because they feel like they're learning about the world. So to me, all that stuff is super valuable and you learn to play with it, but you also have to have a bit of that, you know, really serious, thought out news. The challenge is like, how do you package that in a way that people will click on?
Yeah, that's one of the ways that I approach things is you have to have two things, right? You have to have good information. I mean, that's number one. You have to have that, but you also have to be interesting, right? Yeah, because if you have good information but you're not interesting, no one's going to pay attention to you. But the corollary, which I used to call the Glenn Beck corollary, is you can be really, really, if you don't have good information, you better be really, really interesting. Glenn Beck never had good information, but I couldn't stop watching him because he was really interesting, you know. So those are the two things that I try to do. You know, you're looking for good information. You try to present it in a way that's going to be interesting and a different than what you're going to get from everywhere else. As I knock my microphone around to try to get back to my list of questions. Let's talk about what your goals are for the politics team here at the Tribune. One of the things that I think that we do really well is accountability reporting, looking into things, trying to hold elected officials to account for their decisions. I think that's really, really important. Can you talk about your philosophy when it comes to that? And what are some of the other areas that you're hoping that we take a focus on?
Yeah, accountability is absolutely the most important thing we do here. And for anybody who has a subscription in the community, for anyone who doesn't have a subscription in the community, the reason why you should care about the Tribune, the reason why you should care about other local outlets is that we are constantly working to uncover corruption, to make sure that the environment is taken care of, that our officials are telling the truth in public and in private. And I think that's absolutely the most important thing that local coverage does for a community. And it's why a place like the Tribune, nonprofit, is so important for the community.
Yeah, I was at a legislative hearing yesterday, and you know, there were other reporters there, and they're tweeting, they're live tweeting it. Here's what's happening. Here's what's happening. But you know, I think one of the things that really adds value, and I'm not trying to toot my own horn here, but what I try to do is provide context, provide why is this happening. It's not enough to just say, okay, a bunch of people who are against the president's vaccine mandate want the legislature to do something. Okay, well, I mean, you can do the blow by blow, but that's not reporting. That's just doing a transcript, right? You know, one of the things that really struck me, and I'm just going to talk about this meeting for just a second, is I was wondering how that item got on the agenda in the first place, because there was a really fired up group of people who showed up, and they were expecting these elected officials to do something when they couldn't. They couldn't do anything at that point. And that's one of the things that I tried to point out in this article is anything that the legislature does, we're looking at months down the road before they can take any action, if at all. But they got people so wound up. And it was to me, it felt like a really cynical ploy to try and score some political points. Now we're going to see these bills in the legislature. I mean, it's coming. It's going to happen. But to take that time in a September committee hearing when the legislature doesn't even start for three more months, and they're not going to be able to really do anything. And most likely, if any bill passes, it's going to go into effect maybe at some point in March at the earliest, or maybe even May. So we're looking months down the road, and it doesn't really help anybody. So yeah, it was interesting this happened, and people booed lawmakers, but it was all sound and fury, signifying nothing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're not stenographers, right? There's a reason why you have your job, and it's because you're constantly adding insight and context to things. And I think Tribune coverage, I haven't met anybody who hasn't told me this, is at its best when it's adding those things, when it's giving that analysis. And the fact that you could kind of step back from this and be like, you know, this wasn't going to go anywhere. What is the reason why lawmakers would do this? Is really valuable, I think, for people to hear. You know, they have a base that they want to make happy, and they can't do it with legislation, but they can do it with a big dog and pony show.
Exactly. It was a dog and pony show. It was a therapy session. It devolved into the Festivus airing of grievances when they got off topic and were complaining about unemployment and benefits, you know, and maybe it made some people feel good, but it was the first time that they had met to discuss anything since before the summer, because they took July and August off. So he took 2 months off, and you're going to put this on the agenda for half an hour. Why? And ultimately, I didn't get the answer as to why, because they refused to answer that. But I asked that question: how did this get on the agenda, and what is the purpose? And you can see this coming. So it's just a really cynical thing to do. And so, you know, at least that's what I'm trying to do. And it's good to hear that that's one of the things that you want to do as well. Now, not only are you over the politics part of this, you're also focusing a lot on our environmental team, who do some great reporting as well. What are some of the things that you hope to bring to the table, or some areas of focus that you hope to highlight as you're over that part as well?
Yeah, I almost think climate change and water issues are almost part of every single story from here on out in Utah. It's part of the growth story. It's part of the economy story. It has everything to do with our outdoor recreation. And what I'm hoping to do with that team, and it's a good overlap with the legislature, because there are policy decisions on the table in the next 5 years, which are going to affect the people listening's great, great grandchildren. If we decide to save the Great Salt Lake or not, which is going to be a decision, and that could be it already is in some ways an environmental catastrophe, and it could get significantly worse and create really bad health problems up and down the Wasatch Front. What's going to happen to the Colorado Basin Compact, which is turning 100 next year? The Colorado River is getting smaller every year. The demands on it are getting bigger every year. It hasn't reached the Pacific Ocean in 30 years. And, you know, Utah lawmakers are trying to grab pieces of it for the Lake Powell pipeline. Is that water going to be there? Is growth sustainable in southern Utah? These are all questions which are going to have to be answered in the next 5 to 10 years. And I think having the environmental team overlap with the legislative team is a really good fit for that reason.
Yeah, there are some very big decisions that are going to have to be made, and lawmakers know this is coming. You know, they're talking about how population along the Wasatch Front is going to double in the next 30 years. Where are we going to put all those people? How are we going to get them water? How are we going to make our transportation work? I mean, housing, like I just mentioned, you know, that's there's going to have to be a major change in the way people view housing. We've already started to see it where they're talking about lawns. You know, do we need lawns? You know, let your lawn go brown. They're talking about monitoring water or putting the water meters on with some of the money they got from the federal government. But again, these are things that are probably not going to be in place for a couple of years. And meanwhile, you know, we're starting to move into a crisis. And so I think it's important to put our policymakers' feet to the fire and say, you know what? Yeah, you might have to make some decisions in a crisis, but you also, what are you doing to look 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the line? And they're doing an okay job with that. I mean, I've seen them make some of those moves, but there's still a lot to be done. The transportation part of this, how are we going to pay for that as everybody's moving to a hybrid, you know, or electric cars? Are we going to have that kind of infrastructure? These are some really big questions. And, you know, if you're not paying attention to it, if you're only getting your headlines from Facebook or Twitter, then you're missing a really big part of the story. And you're not doing your job as a citizen who has to be a part of this. And so, you know, at least that's what I'm trying to do is help bring some understanding, some perspective, and maybe some thoughtfulness on, you know, what are the really hard policy choices, because these are going to be hard choices, because not only do they have to do these things, they have to find a way to pay for it, you know. And so does that mean, I mean, taxes, everything overlaps with everything, and it's just getting closer and closer and closer now as things start to move faster.
Yeah, and you saw in one of the meetings yesterday, which was on water, some of the legislators were saying, why don't we build more dams? Why don't we find more storage? And that is, you know, diametrically opposed to what a lot of the experts are saying in the field should be done. There's really just not water in the system to keep storing at this point. So it'll be interesting to see where the rubber meets the road on that. There's the Bear River diversion upriver from the Great Salt Lake, which is still in the works as of now. And that's expected to drop the lake level. I think it's over a foot. And it's hard to see how the lake comes back from that if you look at what's happened to some of the other inland salt lakes around the world, which have just dried up and gone away. And, you know, these are big water decisions. We're going to have to make them together. And the legislature is the ones who are going to be plotting our future for the next 10, 20, 30, 50 years.
Well, you know what? It's going to be an interesting ride. Because, you know, I'm really, really worried about where we are going. I mean, I'm a natural pessimist anyway, but I'm really, really worried. And there are some major, major decisions ahead. And I'm glad I'm not the one who has to make them, but I'm going to try and help people understand what the options are and why our policymakers are doing that. It's part of that accountability that we're going to. Okay, so as I wrap up here with Grant Burningham, just something a little selfish question. What album are you listening to right now? What music? What is on your Spotify playlist? What are you listening to at this very moment?
Oh my gosh! So I got the best recommendation for you. There's this French music channel called FIP, F-I-P, and you can find it in like TuneIn, and it just covers everything from like jazz to hip hop to rock and roll. Constantly surprises me, and I honestly think in the last 3 years I haven't listened to anything else. I just listened to FIP.
Interesting. Okay. I mean, because you learn a lot about a person about what they're listening to. So anyway, okay. So we'll look up FIP, and I'll try to put some links to that in the show notes. Grant Burningham, thank you so much for your time today. I sure appreciate it, and I'm sure we'll have a few more chances to talk as well.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
All right. After a short break, we're going to be joined by author Ben Mezrich. He wrote the book that became the Academy Award winning movie, The Social Network. He also wrote the book that was turned into the movie 21, that one about a group of MIT students who were card counting in Las Vegas. He's got a brand new book that he wrote in a record amount of time about the GameStop thing that happened on Reddit. I didn't understand it as it was going on. It happened in January. He's already got a book and a movie deal out of it. The book just came out. They move really, really, really fast. So we'll speak with him. Joining me today is Ben Mezrich. Anything he writes, I immediately read because he has a narrative style that I find unique and compelling, and he does a damn fine job at storytelling as well. His brand new book is The Antisocial Network, The GameStop Short Squeeze, and the Ragtag Group of Amateur Traders That Brought Wall Street to Its Knees. Ben, thank you for your time today. I'm quite excited to have this opportunity to chat.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thanks very much for having me.
Okay, so let's get right into it. The GameStop story. You dig into the story that happened late last year. I've got to say that I am a fairly regular user of Reddit, and even I didn't know what the hell was happening when those things were popping up on my feed. Essentially, the way that I understand it, a bunch of amateur traders on Reddit sort of figured out how to game the system. And it's an incredible story. I don't want to take anything away from you, but talk about this story sort of in a way that people who don't know what was going on can understand, and what brought you to this in the first place.
Sure. I mean, it's a wild story, a very David versus Goliath kind of scenario where a bunch of amateur traders, basically people sitting on their couches at home, who were gathered together on a Reddit board called Wall Street Bets. They took aim at a giant hedge fund and essentially took down Wall Street for at least a few days. I mean, they created what's called a short squeeze by driving the price of GameStop up to ridiculous numbers. And at the heart of it all was this guy in his basement in Brockton, Massachusetts, a guy named Keith Gill, regular guy. You know, he really believed and fell in love with the stock GameStop, which was an absurd company. You know, it's a company that kind of has had its heyday. They sell video game consoles in an increasingly digital world. It's a stock that probably should have been going down towards zero as it was. But he fell in love with it and galvanized this whole community behind it. And they created one of the biggest short squeezes in history. And some people made fortunes while this hedge fund lost billions. It's a very dramatic story. It took place really in 4 days in January. And characters like Elon Musk and David Portnoy and Mark Cuban kind of circle around it and are all part of the story as well.
Yeah, you talk about Keith Gill. He goes by the username Roaring Kid Kitty. And through his live streams and through posts on the Wall Street Bets, they drove the valuation of GameStop, which buys and sells video games, to, at one point, the company was worth more than $30 billion on Wall Street. And that company is not worth $30 billion. And you touch upon something in this book that I find fascinating, is that our economy, and this is just an extreme example, but things are becoming disconnected from the intrinsic value of things. And I see this book as sort of a larger meditation on that whole thing, where in our, you look at cryptocurrency, and you wrote a great book about that. And I suspect you may be writing a book about NFTs down the line, because that's another thing where they have no intrinsic value. And I heard you say in an interview recently that they're worth whatever the mob feels that they're worth. Talk about, you know, what it was like to come to that realization that a huge portion of our economy now is playing with imaginary value and pretty much imaginary numbers.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reality is at this moment in time, the tether is gone. The thing that connects a company stock with the fundamentals of that company is no longer intact. I think we've seen this happen in crypto, and we've seen it now happen in the stock market with meme stocks. But the reality is the value of something is what we all agree the value of it is, just like art, you know, modern art. A few dots on a canvas can be worth anything, depending on what we all agree it's worth. And now that suddenly is happening in the stock market. And I think it took a lot of people, especially on Wall Street, by surprise, because the belief is things always go back to the value. You know, the fundamentals are this, the math tells me this, the algorithm I plug in says GameStop should be worth a few dollars a share at most. But then all these people say, no, I love GameStop. I don't care whether they, you know, sell Pickle Rick dolls and video games in their store. I love GameStop, so I'm going to buy the stock. And if enough people say that and do that, well, that stock price will go up and the value of that company will go up. And suddenly GameStop was worth billions, you know, one of the most valuable companies on the entire stock exchange, because a million people on Reddit decided they loved it. And so, yeah, I think you're going to see this again and again and again. And my realization, or what I believe is really revolutionary, is that we now have to take into account a world where the value of things is based on the community around it, not based on anything else. The community decides what the value of any stock is. And I think we're going to see this again and again. Look, GameStop is still sitting at 180 or whatever dollars a share. And what's crazy is their earnings come out and they can't possibly be what the stock price is, because they're just not that company. And so they're fighting against the fact that they've got this inflated price, as long as people agree to pay that much for it. And then you look at crypto, you look at things like Dogecoin, which makes no sense at all, right? It's a coin, a crypto coin that was made as a joke, that has no use, that has an almost unlimited supply. It can't be worth anything. And yet Elon Musk tweets about it and everyone gets on Reddit and Twitter and says, I love it. And it goes up. And I think that's the way the stock market works now. It's a circus. So
I wonder how much you think the pandemic played into this, because there's an economist that I speak to every once in a while. And he said, you know, during the pandemic, at least the early stage of the pandemic, when the first stimulus check out, you had people sitting at home bored on their couches. And some of them had a little extra cash in their pocket. So they decided to go buy Dogecoin or whatever, because they were bored, which sort of helped drive, again, something that shouldn't be worth anything into the stratosphere. And I'm wondering if that played a role.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, when you read my book, you'll see the pandemic is front and center in that. I don't think this would have happened the way it happened without it. I think regular people were stuck at home. They had these stimmies, you know, their stimulus checks. They suddenly were handed money. You're supposed to go pay for groceries or pay your rent with that money, but that's not what you're going to do. You're going to make a bet. And it's this YOLO, investing, the idea that, hey, I'm going to take a shot at this. You only live once. If I take $1,000 and I go buy groceries, that gives me a couple weeks. But if I take $1,000 and buy GameStop and it goes to $1,000 a share, I just made an enormous amount of money. And so that was really part of what piloted this whole thing. The idea that, you know, there was found money. Everyone knows, if you go to Vegas a lot, which I do, that there's nothing better than found money. There's nothing better than money you didn't earn, because that's the money you want to play with. And I think everyone had that idea that we're going to play with this money. And then there was a movement. I really think that, I believe very heavily, there was a lot of anger and a lot of bubbling up anger, both at the pandemic, but also at Wall Street going back all the way to 2008, that drove this. And so I think it's a mixture of things, but the anger is what really pushed this over the edge.
I think you make a great point. I'm wondering how many times people have brought up the tulip crash of 1637 to you. I know I'm not being original at all. They're not saying anything that's going to blow your mind, but I'm wondering how many times people have that example when they've been talking about this.
Yeah, all my books. You know, the idea of bubbles and bubbles crashing, you know, tulip, the tulip phenomenon, the tulip phase. That's I think you could definitely make the case that the GameStop is certainly a bubble. I mean, there's you know, no rationality other than the fact that the community got behind it for it to be worth that much. But at the same time, you know, for me, I don't have a problem with a tulip being worth a ton of money. I don't have a problem with modern art or NFTs or anything. I mean, look, gold. Why do we even choose gold? Gold is not the rarest element. It's not, you know, it's we don't even know how much gold there is. We've decided gold is worth a certain amount, and that's what it's worth. You could say the same thing about any gem or anything. So I don't have a problem really with the disconnect and the idea that, you know, bubbles happen and bubbles do burst, but also other bubbles don't burst. Gold, to me, continues to go forward because we've agreed that it goes forward. And I don't think there's any difference between that and saying Bitcoin, you know, should go forward because we all agree it goes forward. Or GameStop. If everyone really decided I'm not going to sell my GameStop, it could stay as high as it is. But, you know, you have to at some point decide that the fundamentals aren't important. And I think Wall Street has trouble with that idea. In the short term, they can make that assessment. They can say, oh, you know what? There's a short squeeze going on, so the price is going to go up. But they always think at some point it's going to revert back to what it's actually worth. I would argue there is no such thing anymore. You can't say what GameStop is actually worth anymore, because that is not something you can calculate.
Yeah, this whole incident exposed, I think, that part of the market. And speaking about people selling their stocks, at the middle of this is Robinhood, who stopped to stop people from selling when the group of traders. They're all angry at Wall Street, or at least there's a number of them who are angry at Wall Street, and they see this sort of as a crusade against the people who make money on Wall Street. And then all of a sudden, so they're using Robinhood, which is supposed to democratize all of this. And then Robinhood is like, whoa, stop. We're not going to allow you to do that anymore, which just makes things worse.
Yeah. So Robinhood is this incredible app that basically hands the tools of any Wall Street trader into anybody's hands. So you can be sitting on your couch with your phone and you can buy and sell stocks. You can buy and sell options. There's no minimum balances. There's no fees. So that's the way it democratizes finance. But the reality of Robinhood is it makes its money off of Wall Street, not off of its people who use it. The users of the product, not the customers. So everyone was putting their trades in through Robinhood. And then Robinhood got something called a collateral call. They basically had a clearing problem where there was so much crazy volatile buying through their app that they had to come up with $3.8 billion just as collateral to the Federal Clearing Commission, basically. And so they had no choice. They basically froze buying. And this is what they say. So it gets grayer. But anyways, they had no choice but to freeze people from buying GameStop. And when that happened, it ended the short squeeze because Wall Street could still get out of their positions. They had no problem. But regular people couldn't continue to buy the stock and send it upward. And so the short squeeze died, essentially. It had almost hit 500 and then it dropped back down to 200. And a lot of people got hurt. A lot of people were taken by surprise by what Robinhood did, because Robinhood was supposed to be, I mean, you know, Robinhood, they're supposed to steal from the rich and give to the poor. And what they actually did was the opposite. They would argue they had no choice, but a lot of people see conspiracies in this because Robinhood makes its money from the hedge funds. It has all these connections to Citadel, and Citadel has connections to Melvin Capital. And so it looked really ugly. And that's what led to the congressional hearings. That would lead to a lot of politicians getting involved. But yeah, the regular person, you know, loves Robinhood and then really did get screwed by Robinhood. So it's kind of an intriguing drama there.
I think your book points out it's really good at pointing out some flaws in these high profile systems. One, the fact that Wall Street, you know, it's the value is now whatever everybody says it is. The value is based on sentiment. But when you talk about Robinhood and the congressional hearings, and we've seen this with Facebook and everything, Congress has no clue how to deal with this rapidly moving technology because it's essentially a bunch of old people who don't know how to talk about this. The experts, you know, they're not experts. I remember when former Utah Senator Orrin Hatch was talking about Napster and he wanted to have a virus that blew up people's computers. They just don't understand this. And so, you know, things are moving so fast and they change so quickly that I think really found a couple of fault lines in our society. One about value, one about technology versus versus regulation. And then one, just, you know, you're also tapping into part of this populist anger that we're seeing where the rich keep getting richer. They do well when other people are not doing as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think you aimed at, those are sort of three of the real big points of my book. I mean, the technology thing is really interesting. There's a scene in the book where Robinhood, which is basically the ultimate unicorn company in Silicon Valley, and they're having this meeting with people who actually do the piping, the clearing stuff, which is incredibly boring, as it were. And one of the Robinhood guys is literally standing on a skateboard during the meeting. And it just shows you that, well, these guys are hotshot unicorns. They couldn't, you know, they don't want to pay attention to all of these rules that actually go back to all the way to the 1930s. Banking rules are archaic. And they haven't caught up to the technology of what's going on. And you also see that in the congressional hearing, where all these congressmen and women have no idea even what to ask Citadel or what even to ask Melvin Capital. And the questions they ask are almost kind of ridiculous. They're asking Robinhood about payment for order flow when they really don't even understand how market making works. And none of us can really understand. The technology is moving so quickly that if you're not in the center of it, you're on the outside and you can't really see it. And then, you know, this bubbling up anger, the sentiment trumping fundamentals, I think it is a big core key of this whole thing, that people really are moving on their emotions, and markets move on emotion more than it moves on any of the technicals. All of this kind of comes to the head in that story.
Yeah. So here's the big question from Freedom Book. What does this all mean? You know, I get the sense from reading it that you, or at least the people that you spoke, you interviewed for this book, seem to believe that there is a revolution in the offing. You know, there are other people who are wedded to, I guess, the old ways. And this is a phrase that my wife and I use all the time. Whenever there's a new piece of amazing technology, we just say, our grandparents would absolutely crap their pants, this sort of thing. It would blow them away. And I think that there's a huge tension point. So what do you think is coming? Is there a revolution coming in this whole thing? Or are we going to revert to the mean, where Wall Street figures out how they see where their vulnerability is, and now they're going to try and fix that? Or are they going to adapt this and just continue on their merry way?
Yeah, I mean, it's great, great question. So Wall Street definitely is attempting to adapt. They have hired teams of people who just scour the Reddit boards looking for what the next meme stock might be.
Awesome.
Wall Street is also being very careful about not being public about what they short. The idea that you can short a company during a pandemic feels ethically wrong. And now they've noticed that when it looks wrong, they can become targets. And that's essentially what happened to Melvin Capital. Hoping that someone else fails so that you make money feels very un-American, even though short selling is a big part of our economy. And it's good to point out when a company is built on, you know, falsehoods and things like that. But, you know, you have to take into account. So hedge funds are going to be even more private than they already are, and not try and avoid public options and things like that. You know, going forward, I do see this as a revolutionary change. I do see the meme stock phenomenon and the crypto phenomenon, NFTs. This is all part of one thing where what we value is changing and what things are worth is changing. It all has to do with the virtual world, the digital world, and the fact that the real world is becoming less and less important. And these online worlds are becoming more and more important. And I think that we're going to change as a society as we become more and more into this new world. So communities like Reddit and Twitter and Facebook are our world now. And they are where we're going to trade our information. And it also gives the power to the mass. So in a good way, it democratizes finance. But in a bad way, you have mob power now, times 10, times 20. 9 million people on Reddit, on one Reddit board, have more money than any hedge fund and can move a stock or even a market quicker and in a more organized fashion than any Wall Street hedge fund can. And so I think going forward, whether it's going to be regulation or whether it's just going to be this Wild West free-for-all, we're going to see swings like this. We're going to see Dogecoin. We're going to see things like this happening over and over again. As the mob realizes its strength and its power.
Well, you know, I'm also an eternal pessimist. And so I look at this and I see how easily public sentiment, at least in some portions of the United States and the rest of the world, easily manipulated. We look at anti-vax information that's out there. We look at whether or not people believe that the 2020 election was stolen. People are very manipulated by these very same networks. And that also can be that also, I guess, scares me at some level, because while it may open up these tools or these areas to people who want to get into them and may have been frozen out before, there's also the potential for a lot of bad actors to get involved too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the big problem is that, you know, we all want everyone to have control of their own money and their own opinions and their own lives. We believe in that freedom and liberty and all that stuff. But at the same time, there's danger in that, because people on the whole don't always do what's the right thing for themselves and don't always make the right decisions and are easily swayed, but are also looking to be swayed. You go on the internet and you try and find opinions that you already agree with. You're not trying to learn something as much as you're trying to have what you already think you know seem right. And that makes things very, very dangerous in the whole world, politics and medical stuff and science stuff. We're not looking for a scientist to tell us something we don't want to hear. We're looking for a scientist to tell us something we do want to hear. And we don't care so much whether it's true. And that's a very bad thing. And I think financially, in the financial world with GameStop and all that thing, there's a similarity in that you're looking for communities that you agree with. You're looking for communities that are going to tell you what you want to hear. And you want to make money doing what you believe already. And I think the idea of taking down Wall Street, of bringing down this system that has, quite frankly, screwed the regular person for generations, was very appealing. And I think the pandemic really brought it to a fore, because the reality is, while everyone was sitting on their couches and losing their jobs and not being able to go out and losing their lives, Wall Street was doing just fine. You know, these guys were making more and more money sitting at home and not having to go to work, and just frankly doing better and better as everyone else was doing worse. And so I completely understand and agree with the sentiment that it's time to win one. Yeah, it's time for the regular person to make some money. But I also see the dangers in it. And I think that the risk is not equitable. That's another whole point I like to make, is that a guy on Wall Street who gets into a position and the position doesn't do well and they lose money and they get out, they still go home to the $30 million mansion and they move on to another position. While the regular person who puts $1,000 at the GameStop loses the $1,000 and then can't pay their rent. So there has to be some level of control. People can't just be allowed to do whatever they want, because when they do, they end up getting hurt. And that's true in a lot of these things. So, you know, there's no easy solution to this, because really you don't want to tell people you can't invest your money. You can't make a bet if you want to make a bet. But at the same time, you have to have your eyes open. You have to know the risks you're getting into. And that's tough.
Exactly. How fast did this come together? Because this whole story came to a head in January. We're talking in early September. There's already a book, and you've inked a movie deal out of it. Well, how quickly did this whole thing come about?
Yeah, I wrote the whole book while we're talking, actually. This has been a crazy situation. Like, this came to a head in January. I was watching it happen in real time. I start getting all these emails and tweets from people saying, you should be writing this because it's what you write about. And so I really just started. I was writing it while it was happening. I wrote the book in not a very long time. I had sold the movie by the end of that week, actually.
Wow.
Hollywood Bidding Wars. MGM is making the movie, and it's the same people who did The Social Network, with the addition of Aaron Ryder, who produced Arrival and Memento. It's an incredible group of people. And I believe we'll be shooting later this year as earliest, but we'll see. But it happened fast, and I wrote the book fast. The reality is I write all my books quickly. Bringing Down the House, which is kind of my first successful book, I wrote that in about 9 weeks. And I wrote it in Vegas, going to a different casino every night. I wrote Accidental Billionaires in about 11 weeks. And so I'm not the guy who takes 2 years to write a book. I write a book in 3 months every time. But this one was exciting because it was writing it while it was happening. So you're trying to talk to people who are literally in the midst of it. And honestly, the GameStop story is still going on. I mean, look at GameStop today. It's still the potential of who knows what's going to happen with it. It's still $100 a share.
And people have also turned their attention to AMC now, too. They're trying to do the same thing.
Another one that's happening with, and Robinhood itself, the stock, you know, IPO'd, and who knows what's going to happen with that. But AMC is another interesting part of it. I mean, they took aim at AMC because the same company was, you know, was involved. Everyone was shorting AMC. And during a pandemic, we're shorting movie theaters, and it doesn't feel right. We love movie theaters. Do we really want AMC to fail? And so regular people were easy to to gather around and say, I want AMC to succeed. I'm going to bet on it. And the sentiment investing became very, very powerful. And so, yeah, AMC, who knows what's going to happen to it going forward.
The book is The Anti-Social Network, The GameStop Short Squeeze, and The Ragtag Group of Amateur Traders That Brought Wall Street to Its Knees. Ben Mezrich, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
I appreciate it. And I really enjoyed talking to you. So thanks so much.
My thanks today to Grant Birmingham, the new State Watch editor for the Salt Lake Tribune. He takes over the politics and government reporting team on Monday. Also, my thanks to Ben Mezrich. His new book, The Anti-Social Network, The GameStop Short Squeeze, and The Ragtag Group of Amateur Traders That Brought Wall Street to Its Knees is available now. If you have a moment, I'd like to ask you to leave a rating and review for this podcast wherever you can. If you haven't yet subscribed, just hit that subscribe button wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have any feedback, you can email me at bschott@sltrib.com. We'll have another conversation for you soon. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Brian Schott.